am Charlotte Henry, and you're listening to House of Comments. We're very pleased to have you. Hello, Emma Burnell. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. It's been quite a hectic week. Last week, we thought there was not a lot going on. This week, quite a lot of stuff has gone on. Let's start with the quote-unquote proper politics. I think that's the right place to start, which is Rishi Sunak rowing back, but maybe not, but sort of, but is on a load of green stuff towards net zero. And I say maybe not, sort of, because we'll get to the fact that I think some of the policies he named weren't actual ever policies, were not things that were going to happen. So we'll come to that in a minute. But let's start with the things that are real and are happening. There's the pushing back the sale of petrol and diesel vehicles ban on that from 2030 to 2035. That's quite significant. So that was the big thing that leapt out to me.
New petrol and diesel vehicles. Let's be very, very clear. The second-hand market would still exist.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Yes, good point. Thank you for making
that. That's an important point.
No one was coming around to set it, to shut down every second-hand car dealership.
Exactly.
No, very good point.
The idea that this is in favour of people who are poor. People who are poor are not buying brand new cars.
No, and the whole debate around electric rollout and the sale of electric vehicles also needs to be about the infrastructure of charging and charging points and those things as well, which we're doing better at, but it's still nowhere near where it could or should be here. That's also an important issue. But that was one of the main things. And then there was also quite a lot of blather and talk about things like banning, like stopping people eating meat and forced car share. Like, I slightly lost track of it, but what was clear is he was listing a whole load of things that he and lots of other people, frankly, of all sorts of political spectrums wouldn't like, but they were never going to happen.
No. And, you know, when they're asked, well, where has this come from? It's like in the appendix of a consultation document of 4 years ago of the DfE. It's like, well, it's never been put into law then. It's never been suggested of being put into law.
No, no, they were not real things that were going to happen. They were just a list of stuff. But obviously, there are some things that happen. And there was also, like, there was talk about taxes on flights and trying to stop people flying. That wasn't really real either. So there was a lot of stuff kind of pulled out the ether. What's interesting about this is, and, you know, I don't think I'm overstating it to say you and I are not particularly environmental policy experts, so you can listen to other people.
I did run an environmental organisation for 3 years.
You did, but like in terms of what is going on now, it's not particularly our policy specialism. So you can dig into other people for that. What I think is interesting is how this is playing out. Because Sunak obviously thought this kind of bonfire would be a home run, at least with his own side, and then would provoke a response. And I want to come on to that. I'm not totally sure it is a home run, because there are people, and not just, there are people in the Conservative Party that have spent a long time trying to make their party have very strong green credentials. And this could really damage that. Now, we should also say, I do want to make the point that actually, by all calculations, the government says we will still get to net zero by 2050, which, you know, is a good thing. They think, you know, we are on target. You can loosen these things to help people, and we will still get to the final end point. And that may well be true, and that would be good. But
it might be true, but the problem is that we're backloading too much of it. The last bit of getting to 2020 should be the smallest bit, and the biggest bits need to happen earlier. Otherwise, that 2050 goal is not realistic. And
yes, that's an interesting point. The other thing I was going to say to you is, when you use the phrase backloading, dare I suggest that in making this decision, Rishi Sunak is aware that he won't have to deal with it.
Absolutely, of course. It's classic. You know, they'll go out of government and then they'll start screaming at Labour because they're picking up the pieces.
It feels like, you know, someone saying a thing that they want, knowing they won't have to deal with the consequences of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, we don't know who'll be in government by 2035, 2040, 2050, but you take the point I'm making.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's vapid. Frankly, this whole thing, it's like they looked at Uxbridge and they're looking at the Red
Yes,
Bull.
yes.
They have these very unnuanced sense of these mythical sets of voters. You've got your metropolitan liberal elites who are all exactly the same, muesli eating, sandal wearing, Guardian reading lawyers.
Well, they're just called the Lib Dems.
Yeah, well, that is the Lib Dems, to be fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, there's no nuance, no sense of, you know, the fact that people in cities actually have quite a lot of poverty, quite a lot of difference. And then the fact that, you know, that all the Red Wallers are anti-environmental policy. They're all basically Lee Anderson on speed. And it's just not actually fair or true to any part of the electorate to have these very simplistic notions of who they are and what they want.
I think you're right. I also think basically every political organisation and party does that to a lesser or greater extent. But you're right. We're seeing it in this. No doubt about it. I also think there is a bit of a... Well, I think what you're getting at, let me phrase it this way, is they have used the environment as... it's basically a culture war thing. And that's what I wanted to get, really wanted to get to. When I said you and I won't, you know, delve into the specifics of the policy, it's because I really wanted to get into the politics of it, which is, I think they have decided the only way to stay alive, and we've seen this with loads of things, haven't we already, is a bit of a culture war. Now, I don't think
climate change is a middle class issue, which is bullshit, because actually the people who most suffer, you know, the poorest areas are lower. They are lower down. They are closer to getting flooded. That is just true. And that will become more and more true as these flood risks increase.
Well, let's also think about it with you, Les.
Yeah.
Many of the first areas in London that needed the air cleaning up were areas that are very, very poor in London.
Absolutely. And also, I'm not being funny, but the poor people in London, because we actually have quite a decent public transport system in London, they don't drive.
Plenty of people who are not poor don't drive in London because there's more trouble than it's worth. So, yeah, you're
right. I have a car, right? It's ULEZ compliant, so it's not a problem. It's 10 years old. It's a petrol car, but it's a small one, so I'm not overcompensating for anything, which I think I've said to you before. But, you know, I drive it maybe once a week. And that's when I go out, not into town. I never drive into town. Never. It wouldn't even occur.
So there's all of this going, but let's focus on this culture war thing, because obviously it then forces Labour to respond. And I guess what the Conservatives want is for Labour to say, no, we have to do these things because it's important. And then the Conservatives can say, well, Labour isn't on the side of working people. I assume in like basic terms, that's the plan.
That's the basic plan, yeah. But it, I think Labour have been quite clever at not buying it.
Great book. You should all buy that book. what has the Labour response been? Unpack it for us.
Essentially, they're just saying, look, this is A, these policies that you've said that you're banning don't exist. B, we do have to get to net zero, and actually being ahead of the game in terms of being world leaders is good for our economy, good for working people, good for jobs.
And good for Britain's status in the world.
And good for Britain's status in the world. You know, we want to attract investment, not repel it. We don't want major businesses putting out extraordinary statements like government.
Well, was it Ford that I read?
Very
unimpressed. Because the problem, I mean,
Two weeks ago, the government were reassuring BMW that they weren't rolling back on these targets.
Well, this is the thing. We absolutely know that the one thing businesses abhor is instability and a lack of predictability, particularly businesses that have massive manufacturing and logistical operations, i.e. car makers. And so it is not good for... You can pretend you're doing well for business, but changing things on a dime does not help business.
No,
It does. Business needs predictability. So that there was a backlash from the business community. You're absolutely right. There was also a furious backlash.
It's extraordinary to have done it practically on the anniversary of the mini budget. Like, we're going to smack business around once a year now.
There was also a furious backlash from within the Conservative Party. Said, you know, you've articulated Labour's response, but there was, you know, there's a lot of people within the Conservative Party very unhappy about this. As I said, I think I saw some quite unhappy comments from Sir Simon Clarke, who used to be in the cabinet. But most notably, of course, was the interventions from Zach Goldsmith, Lord Goldsmith, and Boris Johnson. Now, one might,
isn't it? Because all of those are not people. I mean, Zach Goldsmith has a long, long history of environmentalism.
Sure.
Simon Clarke and Boris Johnson are not people you would necessarily. Like, I mean, I know that Boris Johnson did do a lot of promising on net zero. He did a lot of promising on lots of things. That's the
But he made, like it or dislike it, agree or disagree, he made green part of his brand.
That he gives.
Yes.
It feel like his vibe. So it's interesting.
Oh, no, I disagree with that, actually. He made, again,
Carrie,
you know,
cared about it. But it was the word was always, it's Carrie's thing, not Boris's thing.
That might well be true, but he always at least tried to project an interest in the environment and wanting the Conservatives and the British government to be a Green Party government. That's, and Cameron started that, didn't he? But anyway, he has annoyed Sunak too many different elements again with this.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair to Rishi Sunak, there is so many, the Conservative Party at the moment is so fractured that it's almost impossible to do anything that won't piss off at least two parts of that fracture.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
So, I mean, the easiest thing is to do nothing, but that would have still, you know, and I think it's interesting that the day after this, Jeremy Hunt's going around saying we're not having any tax cuts. I think this was the fight they wanted to have because they don't want to have the one about tax cuts.
Mm. Well, obviously that will play out over the coming months. Just before we move on from this, your comment about saying the easiest thing to do would be to do nothing got me thinking. This was definitely an attempt from Rishi Sunak to go, I'm doing a thing, I'm being proactive, I'm stamping my authority. I just think as a play, that's quite interesting. We don't know what else he'll do it with. We don't know how the rest of it will play out. But that was clearly also part of this, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's classic Sunak the accountant. It's all cost-benefit analysis, short-termism. You've got to make this book balance rather than thinking about what we need to do over the next 10 years.
Well, obviously the person leading the response for this would be Ed Miliband, the Shadow Environment Secretary. So let's talk a little bit about Ed Miliband, because you and I were debating whether to discuss this, which is obviously the fallout from the Dispatches, Times, Sunday Times investigations into Russell Brand. And obviously a lot of it doesn't touch into politics. You and I could discuss the culture around the allegations, which he has absolutely denied, we should say. He is absolutely clear that he has denied the allegations against him. But of course, the question has been asked to Ed Miliband, in light of these allegations, do you feel bad about doing an interview with Russell Brand? Now, part of me is tempted to just lay into Ed Miliband here, say it was a pathetic thing to do. He never, like, talk to proper journalists if you want to do it, blah, 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 blah. That's part of my temptation. And I genuinely don't remember what I said at the time, by the way. So I'm really like walking a tightrope here.
I was in favour of it at the time.
Which, yeah, let me finish, because I think the other part of me is saying, well, actually, politicians do need to engage on platforms and with communities beyond the blooming comment pages of The Guardian or whatever. Absolutely. And so that was back in whatever it was, 2015. So let's just deal with that. So obviously Ed Miliband is saying now he regrets it. I'm not entirely sure, this is me being more generous than I thought I would be to Ed Miliband, that he can really be held responsible for allegations that were not in the public 8 years ago.
Yeah, I think the trying to put the focus on Ed Miliband is a bit silly.
I think it's fine to ask him the question, I don't think it needs to be asked more than once.
Might have responded, yeah, shouldn't have done that. But then that's it. That, you know, put that bit of it.
Yeah, I don't think it needs discussing anymore. The other thing I said to you off air, when I was watching Dispatches and seeing these allegations laid out by these various women, I felt a profound sense of guilt. Because, as I say, we don't know what Russell Brand did or didn't do. He has put out his denials and, you know, the process will play out. We don't know. But for, I remember sitting there laughing at, like, I really enjoyed Russell Brand's stand-up. I liked particularly the first book, I thought was very good. I quite liked Russell. I liked Russell Brand's comedy. I've seen him live. And then to see that there is the potential that the jokes I laughed at would cover for some horrific alleged behaviour was, I found that deeply distressing for me. Like, I felt a sense of guilt at that. If this comes, if this plays out and gets proven to be true, yeah, I will feel in some way complicit with the culture that allowed it.
So I wasn't a big Russell Brand fan. It just wasn't my cup of tea. But I certainly know what it's like when someone you've absolutely worshipped turns out to be less than you hoped they would be. So I'm writing my newsletter about this week. And the example I've given is Joss Whedon, who was the creator of Buffy. Now, Buffy is something that has meant an extraordinary amount to me over the years. Really, really big part of who I am. You know, and he, it turns out it was not the best of workplaces. And there are lots and lots, again, of allegations, not of criminal behaviour, but of just poor behaviour. Behaviour that don't fit with the ethos that the show projected. So again, I have that kind of sense of, well, I've worshipped this person, and actually, is there something that I should be thinking about in terms of that? Now, I've been going back and rewatching the shows after these allegations and thinking about, I mean, and they're still brilliant. I'm sorry, but they are. But there are some moments in them that I do view differently now, which is interesting.
Of course,
I think in terms of our complicity in the noughties culture, I'm reading Sarah Dighton's book at the moment, a review copy, which hopefully we will be interviewing her for this podcast at some point. I think we always sort of think that we've come on further than we have. And then we look back with hindsight and we think, oh, my God, that was so bad.
Yeah, obviously, I am. How can I put this delicately? I only became a teenager at the end of the noughties. Yeah. Well, of the 90s. Noughties, obviously, I was.
See, I'm about 10 years ahead of you. I was 15 in 1990. So I
was three. I'm taking a screenshot of that face, and I'll share that in the show notes of the face Emma just gave me. But I think, look, you and I are laughing and sort of being a bit self-deprecating, but there is a serious point here that some very serious allegations have been made, and it is possible that the behaviour in those allegations was covered by someone joking about that behavior. There's a reason, right, Dispatches went with the title In Plain Sight, because the idea was that his jokes and persona might have been the way he covered the wrongdoing that is alleged against him.
Yeah, and again, it was part of that wider culture. The late 90s were all about lad culture. Britpop was incredibly misogynistic. You have women get to behave like lads.
Yes, the ladette culture.
The ladette culture, but they have to then be okay with lots of jokes about tits. And, you know, it just was awkward and uncomfortable. And I think a lot of people who were involved then do look back at that with, you know, mixed feelings.
Okay, are you ready for a highly professional segue now?
Go on.
Stand by. one of the things that contributed obviously a lot to that culture was the tabloids.
Yeah.
And some of those tabloids were owned by one Rupert Murdoch, or owned by Rupert Murdoch, who are now, sorry, that was good. Can we just take a moment at the professionalism of that? I'm pleased with that. Thank you. Thank you. Obviously, Rupert Murdoch has announced he is signed down from News Corp and Fox. As he become the chairman emeritus, his son Lachlan will become chair both those organisations. Now will lead both those organisations. This is, cue the succession theme tune.
No, everyone's bloody doing that. What would he have done if he'd resigned 5 years ago?
It wouldn't have.
Love succession. Don't get me wrong, but it's just like so hackneyed.
It wouldn't have counted anyway. So Rupert Murdoch is standing down. And whatever one thinks of his business acumen or anything else, the effect he's had on politics has obviously been profound. You can like it, dislike it, share his politics, not share his politics. It doesn't matter. The reality is the reality. His papers were a huge part of pushing for Brexit. The Trump stuff in the US is a bit more complicated, I think, because I don't think... I heard Brian Stelter and Peter Kafka on Recode Media discussing this, and they were saying basically... Murdoch Senior, Rupert, is essentially a Mitch McConnell Republican. And we have seen stuff in different court cases that indicate he didn't really like Trump. He played it as a bit of a TV character. Now, you can think that's pretty poor, but there obviously was a bit of disgust at the way Trump conducted himself.
Yes. But they were willing to play into it.
Indeed.
In order to make money. I mean, I think there's a quote straight out of the RICO court case, which is something like, it's not about red or blue, it's about green. The only thing that matters to Rupert Murdoch is the bottom line.
Yeah, again, I think there's probably a little bit more nuance to that in the sense I think he does have an ideological worldview that he wants to promote.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's right wing, but he's right wing in terms of I want to pay as little tax as possible. I think that I should be able to pay as little tax as possible and make as much money as possible with as little social responsibility as possible. He's a small state Republican.
That's probably true, yeah.
And... you know, again, that comes back to his own bottom line is what matters most.
And of course,
you know, he doesn't want to pay taxes. He doesn't want to. And he will do what makes money. And what makes money is crude populism.
And he is certainly attuned to what can be popular and generate eyeballs and sales. He is, or has been, utterly professional. I think there probably has been a diminishing over the years. Look, he's 92. How could there not be? And we have seen, again, they pointed out this postcode on this podcast, and I remember watching it absolutely, that these couple of times, you know, particularly do you remember when he was in Parliament sitting next to Wendy Deng, his then wife, you know, this is the most humbling day of my life. He was quite good. And I think it happened in the recent Dominion case as well. He was quite good at cashing in the I'm just an old man. And I own this company. I don't do the day-to-day stuff very well. When he needed to.
Yeah, he could turn it on, but it was nonsense.
And what's also interesting, of course, is on both sides of the Atlantic, and never mind in Australia, which is obviously his home turf, people were... I mean, the influence he had over politicians and the way politicians of all stripes wanted to woo him was profound.
Yes, because he did have that populist appeal. So if I think it was the son what won it is too simplistic, but it certainly contributed to the surprise defeat of Labour in 92.
And the victory in 97.
And that's why he worked so hard to get the son's backing.
Yeah, I don't think it's only Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell that have determinedly. Let's not be too simplistic here.
But certainly that was a shift from Labour to try and move the Sun.
It worked,
and it did work for a while. And the Sun itself, it is what it is. It's very well written.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the right.
The journalists who work on there are incredibly sharp.
Absolutely.
You know, I can be as snotty as I like about its politics and its outlook, but the truth is, you know, it's good journalism.
Oh, the skills required to write snappy tabloid copy you have to be so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, and it can be great fun. It's not for me. But my brother-in-law, who's, you know, pretty left-wing, he's always read it because he says it's football coverage.
Yes,
it's
far
beyond anybody else's, by head and shoulders.
Oh, his football coverage is brilliant.
And that's what he cares about. And that's fair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's football coverage and the football pullouts and everything. Excellent. Absolutely. It's going to be very interesting to watch how politicians, again, both sides of the Atlantic and in Oz, respond to this. Obviously, 2024, we're probably going to have elections in both the UK and the US, and a variety of Murdoch-owned property.
We could go to 2025 in the UK, but that would mean a Christmas election is not going to happen.
Yeah. So we're going to have elections in 2024 in both the UK and the US, and Murdoch properties, as ever, are going to be really, really important in that. And I think it's going to be a real first test.
Yeah.
To see how, if the shift, if any, happens. Now, I don't think there will be a political shift under Lachlan Murdoch. I can't really see that.
No, I don't. Yeah, he is Kendall.
You did it, not me. Actually, Roman was the one that was more about the dad's politics. But anyway, carry on.
It's continuity, I think, is what I'm saying. He's
right.
Community candidate. I think there will, I think any shift that happens in the politics will be about the newspapers themselves responding to their audience.
Probably.
Rather than a diktat from on high, you must support X, Y, or Z. I think it's been very interesting watching, listening to the Times, particularly Times Radio, because they're kind of, their entire stance is everything is shit and everyone is shit. I wonder if the Times is going to endorse at all at the next election, because I'm not sure
interesting.
They could bring themselves to endorse Labour, but I'm not sure they could bring themselves to endorse the current government either.
That would be very interesting to watch. I'm going to be writing about a lot of this Murdoch-related stuff for my media newsletter, The Edition. So head over to newsletter.theedition.net to make sure you can read that. I'd love to have you. Emma, where else can people keep up with you?
Well, as I say, I'm writing about my own response to the brand allegations. And that's at Hard Thinking on the Soft Left. And I'm also on all the platforms with all the names.
Yes.
Burnell or Emma Burnell _. Don't follow the other Emma Burnell because she's a perfectly ordinary woman who lives in Leeds and has nothing to do with my nonsense.
I did once tweet her by accident. She was like, no, still not that person.
I did it a lot, and I do feel a bit sorry for her sometimes.
Sorry, babe.
She once made a fat joke about me, so fuck off.
Sorry, babe. And so I'm at Charlotte A. Henry across various social media platforms as well, or at Shia Henry. We have a House of Comments Twitter account at HOC Podcast. Always love to hear from you, what you think of the show, what you would like us to discuss. You know, if you send us some stuff in, we're happy to read it out on the show. So do be in touch. Goodness knows what we'll have next week, but we'll see you then.